Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Sam Tracy. Today we bring you to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland for a talk by Admiral Michael Rogers on the current state of world geopolitics and global hotspots for conflict. This program was recorded live on March 10th at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Rockland, Maine. More information on the Midcoast Forum, including past topics and upcoming speakers, can be found at midcoastforum.org. We bring you this conversation now, which begins with an introduction from George Look, Board President of the Midcoast Forum.
So good afternoon. I'd like to welcome our members and guests to the 479th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been hearing from an invited speaker each month on an issue central to U.S. foreign policy. This month, we are pleased to have Admiral Michael Rogers here to speak on the current geopolitical situation and how the world is evolving. Admiral Rogers retired from the U.S. Navy in 2018 after nearly 37 years of naval service, rising to the rank of four-star admiral. He culminated his career with a four-year tour as commander, U.S. Cyber Command, and director, National Security Agency. In those roles, he worked with the leadership of the U.S. government in the conduct of cyber and intelligence activities across the globe. During his broader service in uniform, Admiral Rogers held positions afloat and ashore around the globe, focusing on cyber, intelligence, maritime operations, and national security. His joint service included duty with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, and the U.S. Atlantic Command. In addition, he commanded at the unit, numbered fleet, and service component level with the U.S. Navy. Admiral Rogers is a graduate of Auburn University and holds a Master of Science in National Security. He is a distinguished graduate of the National War College and a graduate with highest distinction from the Naval War College. He is also an MIT Seminar 21 Fellow and a Harvard Senior Executive in National Security alum. Admiral Rogers is currently supporting companies in the private sector, serving as a member of various boards and acting as a senior advisor. He speaks globally to various business and academic groups and is working internationally in the cyber and national security arenas. Mike, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thanks. Okay, well, we want to maximize our time and our interaction. First, can everybody in the room hear me? So what you should take away from that introduction is I lived off you, the taxpayer, for almost four decades, and I am way overeducated. That's what I take away from what I just heard. But what I wanted to do was share some thoughts with you about, so where is the world today? What is shaping it? Where do I think what the implications are for the future? And I spend, as you heard, I spend a lot of time talking to businesses all over the world about, okay, so given that, what do you as a business entity want to be thinking about? But I'll try to make it a little bit more broader, a little bit more strategic. I also want to start up front by saying, I don't do politics. What do I mean by that? I'm not here to argue one party's better than the other, one leader is better than another. I'm here to try to, let's understand the world around us, what's shaping it, how are our leaders thinking, and what does it mean for the future? I leave it up to you to decide good, bad, right, and wrong. My view is, hey, look, I try to be an analyst who sees both sides of an issue. I tried not personally to get sucked into things, because that was my role in the government in many ways, is leading NSA, the largest intelligence organization. Our focus was to help the leaders of our nation and our friends and allies understand what's going on in the world around them, with the view that in so doing, they would make better policy choices, and trying to provide support to our military commanders. So again, likewise, they would make smarter choices. So as we look at what's going on in the world around us, clearly every one of us can realize there's a lot going on. I wish I could sit there and tell you we're in a relatively static period of history with little change, nothing's going on. That is just not the case. I think we all realize that we're in a period of significant change. You can see that domestically for us. You also see that more broadly outside the United States. This isn't a phenomenon that's unique to one country right now. because I would argue that the world around us has broadly changed. So first, I'm going to step back a little bit. I would argue up until about 7-8 years ago, the focus for our nation outside of the United States was largely against the non-state actor, primarily around the terrorist threat. So think about ISIS, think about Al-Qaeda. That tended to shape our priorities in the broader world around us. It tended to be our highest priority, biggest focus. And much of our response to that challenge was very militarily shaped. Those groups were not, if you will, an extension of a nation state. They weren't supported per se by a nation state. And so economic and political were aspects of our strategy, but the single greatest tool in our strategy, if we're honest, was pretty aggressive use of the military against those entities. You could see that started changing around 2018. I was still in the government then, and I can remember thinking at the time, telling the team that I led, as well as at that time I was working for President Trump. I had worked for President Obama before that, but talking to President Trump about, so the world around us is changing, and suddenly the nation state is starting to be much more aggressive and much more a factor. And I would argue the world we're living in now is most broadly shaped by the actions of other nations and U.S. concern about many of those other nations. Now, China and Russia tend to get the biggest amount of publicity or attention, but I would argue it's much broader than that. I'm also really struck by the fact that broadly, three things have started really impacting each other. Technology, economics, national security, all underpinned by this incredible information domain in which information flies broadly everywhere. And quite frankly, for technology and a host of other reasons, much of the information that we're exposed to in the broader world around us now is not accurate. It's not necessarily factually based. It reflects a particular viewpoint. It reflects a particular ideology. It, in many ways, is often designed to elicit emotion and reaction from us. Sometimes you see it pursued by nation states. I was very much part in 2016 of the effort, for example, to try to understand Russian influence and attempts to, if you will, shape the election outcome. So I've watched this very closely with nation states, but I would argue that continues as well as individual groups. The net effect of all this is the world around us is becoming a whole lot more complicated, a whole lot more unpredictable, and much more interconnected, which means the solutions are much more difficult. Solutions take a whole lot more time. And it's becoming, put on top of that, the idea that, and you see this in the United States as an example, but it's not unique to the United States, it's becoming more and more difficult for many nations to achieve internal consensus about how do we come together as societies, as nations, to address some of these issues that we're seeing both domestically, but as well in the broader world. What you're seeing when I look at those three things, technology, economics, and national security, it's interesting how they're all coming together. Increasingly, nation states view technology as the economic engine of the digital economy today and tomorrow. That it's a nation's advantage in technology that will in no small part shape its ability to compete economically in the broader world that we live in. Economics. Traditionally, I can well remember when I worked for President Obama and sitting in the Oval or the sit room going over issues as part of the national security team with him. My memory of that experience, it's almost a decade ago now, but I don't remember the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of Commerce, the U.S. Trade Representative. I don't remember the economic and the traditional national security team necessarily regularly together. That has totally changed. Increasing now, we view national security through the prism of economic security. You see that playing out, I would argue, in a major way in the relationship right now between the U.S. and China, where our concerns from a national security perspective about China are largely shaped by our concerns about their economic policy and our desire to retain technical advantage, if you will, with respect to China, and see how that is shaping U.S. policy and the choices that the U.S. is making. You saw that with President Trump in his first administration, where he focused, for example, on 5G and Huawei is the primary, hey, this is how I'm going to try that combined with the initial tariffs that he put in place. So he said, I'm going to use the economic kind of option, and I'm going to use the technical option as a way to try to shape the behavior of China. I would argue that's continued. If during President Biden's time, I would argue his vision was, hey, I will use technology. He focused on the semiconductor. He said, hey, look, I will use technology both to try to shape China's behavior, but also as a vehicle for the United States to retain advantage in a highly technical world. So these worlds are, these dimensions are all starting to blur together. It means it's a lot more complicated. It means, for example, if you're a business in technology in the private sector, it is not an easy world for you right now, because you're finding yourself sucked into many of these government issues that traditionally, as a company, you would say, hey, look, I'm in the commercial sector. I don't do government policy. I just compete with others. And that is becoming tougher and tougher. And a lot of companies now find themselves stuck, if you will, between this dynamic between the nations. At the same time, we created a world where we built connectivity and interconnectivity into our core, not just technology and information, but our business models. We lived in a world where we said we understand supply chain and we understand process to such a degree that we can disperse production, we can disperse supply chain all over the world, and yet we can still have a high confidence that based on our knowledge, based on our ability to move product, that we can bring it all together at the time and place where we need it, and we can generate enough quantities that the consumer has what they want when they want it. What I think the last few years, particularly COVID and post-COVID, has shown us, the world has a lot more fragility in some ways in it than we thought it did. And so now you've watched the last few years where, as a nation, many of our businesses and our national policies in some way are asking, are we still comfortable with that methodology? Do we need to move some aspects of those supply chains back to the United States or back to friends and allies like Mexico or Canada? Which is interesting if you're a business. You're thinking, okay, I'm an automobile manufacturer, and I potentially moved parts of my part distribution system into Mexico because, hey, ally, neighbor, you made that choice several years ago, and yet now you're looking at a tariff package where you're going, is that the choice that makes sense? Do I need to change that over time? So there's a whole lot of change, there's a whole lot of angst, there's a whole lot of uncertainty out there. I'll take your specific questions. You want to talk about Syria, you want to talk about Lebanon, you want to talk about Gaza. I spend a lot of time in Israel. I'll be back in, I've been there, I think, six times since the 7th of October. I have spent time in the kibbutzes and villages that were destroyed. I've spent some time working with the IDF to try to understand their military activities in Gaza. I'll be back in Israel in another week, for example, to do some business work. If you want to talk about Ukraine, you want to talk about China, I'm going to focus a little bit right now on Russia, because that, at the moment, I would argue that's generally getting the largest attention. And I would also argue that one of the things that's complicating these sets of changes that I've already talked about that were already there had nothing to do necessarily with who was in political power in the United States. You take all that uncertainty, you take all that change, and I would argue throw on top of it now in the United States, but it's not unique to the US, you see the same phenomena in changes in political leadership and the political dynamics in Italy, Germany, France, the UK, the United States. And in the United States, given all this, we have an incoming administration with a very different view of what its role should be, with a very different view about, well, what's the role of America in the broader world? What's the responsibility of other nations? You, for example, see this coming together a little bit very visibly with Russia, with respect to Russia and Ukraine, where the president of the United States argues, look, we need a different relationship between the United States and Russia. And his view, and I say this, I worked for him in the first administration, and I can remember a conversation with him one time, he and I, where we were talking about, he asked me my opinions about Russia, and he said, well, Mike, could I give you a different view? And he walked me through, he said, hey, here's how I look at the problem. I said, well, yes, sir. I disagreed a little bit at the time and said, well, sir, the challenges are. But it's interesting that we have an duly elected individual who has a fundamentally different view about what's the role of the United States in the broader world, what's the role of our friends and allies in that broader world, how should the dynamics between the United States and both our friends and allies, as well as others like Russia that we traditionally have had very adversarial relationships with, how should they change? So one of the things that he has talked about, which I believe is very important to him, is number one, I believe one of his goals is to reset the relationship with the Russians, that his view is a constant confrontation between the United States and Russia is not in the broader interest of either nation or the broader world around us. I'll tell you what he said to me back, it was a while ago, but still, we were talking about Russia, Ukraine back then. And he said to me, why is it that a nation that has among the largest hydrocarbon, oil, and natural gas deposits in the world, why are we focused on trying to restrict that from flowing into the broader global community? Why wouldn't we want more energy made available to the world and its economies? Why wouldn't we want to drive prices down, for example? Why wouldn't we want energy more readily available as an engine, if you will, for broader global activity, economic activity? He said, hey, look, why is it that a nation that has among the largest rare minerals deposits in the world, why would we not want to be able to access that? Why wouldn't we want that on the market? And then the last thing he said to me was, why is it that we want to be so diametrically opposed to the nation state that has more nuclear weapons than any other in the world? Why is it we have just picked this confrontation? Now, I'll take your questions, and if you want to get into it, glad to, but I say this only to highlight, he has a really different viewpoint about what should the nature of the relationship between our nations be. He also views himself as a change agent. He's not a politician. He will sit there and tell you this. I'm a business guy. I'm not a politician. As a business guy, I am focused on outcomes. Politicians, they are focused on bureaucracy and they are focused on process. As a business guy, I'm focused on outcomes. And what I want is a series of outcomes that in his mind will generate a better situation for the United States. He also believes he can't get to a better relationship with Russia while the Ukraine situation is still unfolding. His view, I believe, is, look, you got to take this off the table. If you want to get to a better place with the Russians, we got to make this Ukraine situation go away, which is why he has been so aggressive about, hey, this war has to end. And again, I'm not here to argue good, bad. I'm not telling you I agree or disagree. I'm trying to give you a sense, having spoken with him about this before, this is the way he thinks, and this it tends to shape his view of the broader world around him and the choices that he makes. He also believes fundamentally that much of the rest of the world has lived off the literally tens of billions of dollars, if not more, that the United States has spent on security over the course of the last several decades. And that his view is many of our friends and allies have not paid their fair share. And his question gets to be why. And I think in his mind, his argument is, I'm not interested in continuing that status quo. They need to step up. They need to do more. And so you're watching this unfold. I was in Munich for the Munich Security Conference. I was in the audience when the Vice President of the United States spoke. I never quite heard an address quite like it. But the reaction of the audience, you could have heard a pin drop at the end of the site. People were just in shock, in part because they not only heard a very different view of what America thought of Europe, I think it was also caused in part by what they didn't hear. They thought they were going to hear an address from the Vice President of the United States that was going to talk about America's view on Ukraine. They thought they were going to hear remarks about what is the United States looking for from Europe and how is America's national security policy going to play out with respect to Europe. And that's not what they heard. Instead, they got my characterization. It was a speech that I thought, if I was in Ohio on the campaign trail, I would have expected to hear something like this. This isn't exactly what I would have expected to hear in an international form. And so what you're watching is the Europeans and others are trying to ask themselves, so if the U.S. is going in a fundamentally different direction and has a fundamentally different view of its role in the broader world around it, what are the implications for us, Europe? Does this mean we need to be more independent? Does this mean we need to assume a different role with respect to Ukraine? Does this mean that we need to increase our defense expenditures? Does this mean that we suddenly start needing to view the United States as not just a traditional ally, but are there some areas where we're going to be competing with each other? So you're watching this play out as both nations talk about trade and tariff policy. It's going to be a while before we know exactly what the outcome of this is, but this is a set of conversations that you haven't heard Europe have in a long, long time. And they're trying to work their way through, okay, what does this mean and what are they going to do? It won't be easy for them. I mean, if you fundamentally change the nature of this relationship, for example, they are not used to investing in defense at the orders of magnitude that would be required if the United States, you know, wasn't going to be involved in this. And they would not only have to sustain that level of defense expenditure, the increase for the immediate future, but potentially they'd have to do this for a long time. So how do you sustain the political will, you know, to significantly change what you've been doing for a long time? That's not easy. So we'll see how Europe plays out. I think it's also important and interesting to see that at the moment, America seems to be sending a slightly different message, I would argue, to its friends and allies than its adversaries. If you just look at the trade and tariff policies that are unfolding with China, we're at 20% so far at the moment. What he's talked about with Mexico, Canada, potentially Europe on the 2nd of April, if he goes down the reciprocal tariff approach, which he's talking about, you're talking about 25% as a minimum. So it's interesting to me. He has opted to be a little bit more aggressive with traditional friends and allies and neighbors than he has with others. Now, I think that's in part because he's trying to send a signal to the Chinese that he's interested in the long run in some sort of economic accommodation. That his view is, hey, we can cut a deal. And so I'm trying to signal that I'm prepared to do things differently, I believe. I believe he's also communicating, I'm prepared to be tough with you, but I'm also interested in a deal. It's also interesting to see the difference in the way the United States is talking about China now compared to the way it was. So if you go back to the Biden administration, what you heard from then President Biden was when he talked about China, he talked about things like human rights, labor practices, practices of the Communist Party, surveillance of Chinese citizens, fentanyl, climate change, Taiwan, South China Sea. If you look at what the President Trump has spoken about with China, he has largely concentrated on economics, and he's raised fentanyl as the other issue. I'm struck by when he talks about China, he talks about it in a much narrower way than most of his predecessors. Again, not a criticism, an observation. I think in part his view is by focusing on a narrower subset of the dynamics between our nations, in his mind, it increases the probability potentially of a deal. That it's easier to, if we just focus on the economics and not the other things, it potentially makes a deal and accommodation a lot easier. I think that's the theory of the case in his mind. We'll see how this plays out. It's still very early. One of the things I try to tell everybody, I have this discussion in my own family, and then I'd like to open it up to questions for everybody. There's a huge amount of change right now. There's a huge amount of uncertainty. The reality is we do not yet know where this is going, how others are going to react, and what the impact is for us. It's going to take some period of time, I think, for many of these changes to play out. So we truly understand. We need to keep our eyes and ears open. We need to keep trying to understand the broader world around us. But we also got to acknowledge we're in a period of great flex, great change. And this change is going to take some period of time to play out to the point where we truly understand it. With that, what's on your guys' minds?
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program features Admiral Michael Rogers in conversation with George Look, board president of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. Stay with us as Admiral Rogers answers questions about the most pressing challenges facing current geopolitics today and in the near future.
While we collect the questions from the audience, and I'm sure there will be quite a number of them, I always take this opportunity to ask the first question myself.
Yes, sir.
In the worldview that you're talking about of the current president, is there any distinction between democracies and autocracies? Are they kind of on equal level? I'll deal with all of them in the same way.
I think broadly in his mind, it's, and again, I'll give you an opinion. I don't pretend to speak for the president of the United States. My sense is his focus is much less about a particular form of government and much more about the outcomes that he's trying to generate. It's interesting. He takes different approaches on different issues. So I think he focuses less on the particular dynamics of a form of government and much more on, hey, what are the outcomes that he's trying to achieve?
Then if you could comment a little more on the policy related to Russia on this. Russia has been the aggressor in Ukraine and elsewhere. Do you see that if we accommodate Russia that this is going to stop? That all of a sudden, you know, Putin's ambitions for a greater Russia?
Well, I'll tell
Russia?
You exactly what I told him when he asked my opinion in this conversation a few years ago. I said, sir, the challenge, I believe, is that in order for this strategy to work, you're asking Putin to walk away from what he considers to be his core national interests. I said, that's a tough... I said, if the shoe were on the other foot, I don't think we would be walking away from what we would consider to be our core national interests. So I said, look, the premise of the strategy to me is that I think I'm hearing is we can get to a better place and that will change Russian behavior because we're in a better place. And my concern would be, sir, that's possible. But what I would be concerned about was we're not really addressing or changing the core national interest between us. Like, the Russians have always had this thing about what they call the near abroad, that one of their predominant or fundamental basis of their strategy is no potential adversaries immediately on the border. Always create a buffer space. That's what they did the Warsaw Pact for. Going back a little bit in time, they have always had this belief that you don't want the enemy right on the border, which is why, for example, Ukraine started, in no small part because Putin was concerned. Ukraine was indicating it was going to join NATO. It was going to become a member of the EU. It was both militarily, politically, and economically going to integrate itself with Europe. And I think Putin's view was, I don't want that on the border. We've got to stop that from happening. So I think that's the long-term challenge on the strategy, and we'll have to see how it plays out.
And I can already see there are a lot of questions here about the role that the current policy toward Greenland and toward Panama.
There you go. I mean, who knew that Greenland and Panama were going to be?
How do they fit into that overall scheme?
So I think in part they reflect a view in his mind. Let's talk about Panama first. A view in his mind that it was a mistake that during President Carter's presidency, the decision was made to remove the United States as the controller, if you will, of the canal zone, to turn it back over to the nation of Panama, and to do away with the special prioritization as well as reduced tolls that the United States was granted at the time. I think he looks at that as, number one, that was a mistake. Number two, he talks about the idea in his mind that China has used that as a vehicle to move influence into Panama. Now, interestingly, you just had BlackRock, a U.S. investment entity, just announced that they have bought the ports on both sides of the canal, the Atlantic, the Caribbean side, as well as the Pacific. So perhaps there's an economic solution to this challenge, vice outright invading, so to speak, which I think would have a low probability of both occurring, but being successful in the long run. Greenland is a little different to me. Remember, he talked about Greenland in the first term, so this is not a topic that has come up and we've never heard this before. He has previously expressed interest, I think, both Because when he looks at Greenland, he sees, number one, we already have a significant U.S. military presence up in the northwest corner of Greenland. We've got a significant set of capabilities that are very important to us in terms of warning and some things with respect to space. So we've already got a presence there. As the weather has changed, I think there's concern about our rare earth minerals and mining potentially now going to be an option in Greenland when they weren't previously. So is there an economic dimension to this? I think the fact that it is on the western side of the Atlantic, much closer to the United States than to Europe, also leads him to question, well, why is this a Danish possession? Why is this part of Denmark? I think he keeps talking about this idea of, well, we'll cut a deal, we'll buy it, so to speak. We'll see. I don't see that happening, but who knows?
Let's continue our tour around the world.
There you go.
What role does the Southern Hemisphere, in particular South America, have in this overall strategy? We're back to the Monroe Doctrine.
So it's very interesting. China, for example, has been working aggressively to try to position itself as the champion of the global South, as the large global entity that truly cares about the global South. China's articulation is, look, we're the ones who care about you. Look at the United States. Look at the large economies of the West. They don't care about you. They just view you as an area to extract from. They don't really want to provide you. And that's the argument the Chinese make. Now, I don't think that's a totally accurate argument. So the global South has been trying to make an argument. It's one of the reasons why BRICS, this idea of, well, could you create a counter, if you will, an alternative to the largest economies in the G7, et cetera? Could you create a largely global South-focused alternative that would provide both an economic alternative, for example, might argue, let's move away from the dollar as the primary currency that shapes most of the commercial transactions around the world? I would say the odds of that happening are very small. If you just look at the size of the U.S. economy, you look at the impact, you look at how integrated the dollar is, while there will be some inroads, I think it's very difficult to fundamentally walk away from the current economic structure anytime soon. It's just too large, too significant, and to make the changes that the Global South and others are arguing are appropriate, I just think the level of disruption, a lot of entities would say, hey, it's just economically, it's just not worth it.
The Middle East is another
Never heard
area,
of it. What?
Area that we might want to
yes,
ask
sir.
You a little bit about. What's going to happen now?
The Middle East is really interesting because it's fundamentally undergoing some significant changes. One, Israel, in my opinion, has clearly come to the view that it can no longer accept large, well-funded, heavily armed groups that are committed to its extinction on its borders, that it must execute, following what happened on the 7th of October, that it must execute a series of military operations designed to destroy those groups, their infrastructure, and their weapons. As I said before, I actually was asked to be part of a small group of American retired four-stars to do an assessment of the IDF activities in Gaza from a military perspective. I went over to Israel. I've been in and out of Israel since I was a midshipman in the summer of 1980. So I've been going in and out of Israel for, 40 plus years now. I'm there multiple times a year. I value my friendships there. I know most of the security structure, most of the IDF leadership, many of the political leadership, just because we had such a strong partnership and we did so much together. And I went over to Israel in March, so a year ago. I was asked to be part of this review. And I went over thinking to myself, this is like 9/11 for them. This was a terrorist event on a massive scale. And they are responding, much like the United States did in the aftermath of 9/11. And my takeaway after literally going to some of the kibbutzes and villages, talking to families, looking at the videos of Hamas's activities on the 7th of October, what I found was something totally different. What I found was a government and its citizens who didn't view it as a terrorist event, but viewed it in some ways as a repeat of the Holocaust. That a nation that was founded for the express purpose of protecting those of the faith and ensuring that they would never again be slaughtered or victimized purely on the basis of their faith had failed. That's not what I thought I was going to hear. And what I kept hearing was, never again, never again, never again. We failed in our most fundamental mission. The whole reason the state of Israel was created. We failed. And we've got to make sure that that doesn't happen again. If you look at the aftermath of the response to October, you saw literally tens of thousands of Israelis voluntarily leave their homes around Gaza and up north on the Lebanese border, and telling the Israeli government, until you get control of the borders and those who are on the other side throwing rockets at us coming across the border on the 7th of October, we're not going back. We won't live on the borders. So you literally had tens of thousands of Israelis who have been living in hotels. The government's been subsidizing this. And so what you hear in Israeli society and with the government is, we've got to fundamentally change this dynamic. We've got to remove these groups. We've got to cripple them. So you've seen both Gaza, you've seen the incursions into Lebanon, you've seen the confrontation with two armed confrontations directly with Iran in the last 15 months where the Israelis are arguing. And even as we go after these groups, we need to go after the entity that funds them, the entity that drives them, the entity that is really shaping what Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen are doing. You can certainly have an argument about how they are choosing to do this. And I will be very upfront and say there are some things that I just fundamentally disagree with in terms of execution, where I said, look, as a military guy who has done these sorts of activities in Iraq, Afghanistan, who has tried to identify targets to strike, you know, I have some real concerns about some of the things I'm seeing, but I do believe you have the right to defend yourself. I do believe that going after Hamas and Hezbollah are legitimate aims of a nation state focused on trying to ensure the security of their citizens, and that the thought process behind it is a valid one that's a very real, and that if you're not there, it's hard to understand the depth of this a little bit. What's interesting now is, I think in some ways, how does this end? Are we just signing up to eternal war? What's the political end state? What are you going to turn this over to? How are we going to collectively, because the Israelis are going to be able to do this by themselves, how are we collectively going to be able to rebuild, create a different environment for those citizens? Because remember, those, as evil as Hamas is, there's about 2.1 largely innocent Palestinians living in Gaza. And most of them, 90% of them, have been displaced by the war. It's also interesting that the Israelis are right now making an argument with the United States. We have weakened Iran. Now is the opportunity to really push them and take the nuclear piece off the table. That we should be more aggressive. The Israeli input to us is we should be more aggressive. They're down, they're weak, now is the time to take advantage. The Trump administration has reinstituted what they call the maximum pressure campaign, which is designed to forestall the Iranian regime's ability to sell its oil and natural gas to generate income. I think last year they evaded sanctions and sold something like $54 billion in oil and gas to the broader world. The president's view, hey, we need to stop that. That will then force the regime, once they lose those sources of money, it'll force the regime to potentially come to a compromise with us. Now, we'll see. The president just said this weekend, I wrote a letter to the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, and I said to the Ayatollah, we should sit down and we should negotiate an agreement between the United States about ensuring you don't go to a nuclear development, a weapons program. The Ayatollah over the weekend said, he didn't refer to the United States by name. He just said, we're not going to respond to bullying governments, was the phrase he used. The foreign minister in Iran yesterday specifically said, we will not go to a negotiation table to the United States while these sanctions are in place. If you want us to negotiate with you, remove the sanctions. So Iran is one area I'd be paying a lot of attention to, because I will tell you, this is one area that President Trump was always very frustrated with. He would often talk about, which is true, no other nation has led to the death of more Americans than the Iranians in the last 40 years. Not the Russians, not the Chinese, the Iranians. If you look at them and their surrogates, whether it was Beirut, and I was in Beirut back in 83 and 84, Iraq, Syria, you know, which I agree with. His view is that if you take the emotion out of it, the Iranians have done more against the U.S. than anybody else in terms of loss of life and injury. Sir?
A little bit of a follow-up on that, because you talked about the never again aspect. Someone wants to know, does Israel realize the long-term damage to its national image that's done with that's been done
so,
by
So first, I don't want to speak for Israel, but I'll tell you what I raised a similar, again, as part of this review. And what you'll often hear from Israeli leadership is, look, it is the nature of the situation we find ourselves in that we will always be perceived as the bad ones. We will always be behind in global sympathy. You will often hear that. You know, my input was, remember, you got to think long term here, and at some point in the future, you may need some of these entities. And I also said, and remember, think about the position it puts your number one ally in. We're giving you money, we're giving you weapons, we believe in you, we want to support you. And the rest of the world looks at us and says, why is it that you were supporting some of these actions? Why is it that you were enabling this? So one of the things I tried to say was, well, remember, your closest friends pay a price for this as well. So it's not just you, but we'll see how that works out.
And let's move back to Europe for a minute. Someone wants to know, will more militarily independent Europe have a positive or negative impact on overall stability? I mean, Europe has a history of when they arm, they fight each other, and we have world wars. You know, do we want?
So first, my first question to Europe would be, so if you're committed to increased defense expenditure, if you're committed to increasing your focus on security, what's the prism that you believe is the best way to execute that? Do you want to build around the NATO alliance and the existing mechanisms? Do you believe that you can no longer, trust is the wrong word, but you no longer believe that NATO has the same role or relevance, and therefore you're either going to do it independently, or you're going to try to, as France has been arguing and others for a while, well, the EU should be more than a political entity. The EU should take on a military or a security role. A lot of Eastern European nations disagree with that, arguing, look, we've only got so much money, we've only got so much structure, we cannot provide support to NATO, and now you're telling us you're trying to replicate this. Hey, we just don't have the resources to do that. I would hope that they make the decision that the NATO alliance is the framework upon which to build as they are making national choices, which is always their right. And again, we're going to have to see how this plays out.
And several people wanted to know whether or not you think, well, you obviously don't, but I'll ask the question anyway.
I don't think. A lot of people always said that.
You're giving more credit to President Trump than he deserves, that a lot of this is just a transactional arrangement and not an overall strategy.
I don't think I gave anybody credit. I thought I tried to tell you this is the way an entity thinks. I didn't try to give anybody credit or discredit, so to speak. My attitude always is, look, I think it's important that we need to focus on, so not only what is happening, but why is it happening? What's shaping it? And once we figure out what's shaping it, both what does that mean for the future, but also if we don't like it, how might a good strategy be to respond to that? If you do like it, hey, double down on it, articulate your viewpoint. I'm not into this, and I may have misunderstood the question, so I apologize if I did.
Then a number of people have noted that, like, the word ecology never entered into what you're talking about.
Right. We talked about climate, and we only talked about it once, vis-a-vis China.
But how about overall? I mean, is the lack of emphasis on climate, on human rights, or what effect is that going to have long term?
Again, that's one of those things I think you got to ask over time, because that goes to the whole idea in some ways about what's the primacy of values in shaping your view of the world around you and the choices you make, whether you're a head of state or we make as individuals. What I think I hear at times from the administration is, look, we've been overly focused on some of these things, like energy is a great example. You'll hear him talk about this idea, why would we forfeit a strategic advantage? We have more oil and natural gas than almost any other nation in the world. That offers us strategic leverage. It offers us the ability to create alternatives in the broader world around us. Hey, why would we walk away from that? You'll hear him say that. My question gets to be, remember, you got to think long term here. So what looks good now and seems to make sense now, are we going to be in the same place 20 years from now, 10 years from now? And the kind of changes you have to make to get to a different place, for example, with respect to energy or climate, that we're talking decades of sustained investment and focus. You just don't change an economy in 2 or 3 years or in an administration. It just doesn't work. I would argue that it's almost impossible. It just doesn't work that way. So you got to figure out strategies that play out over time. And to me, his focus is not so much on the longer term. His focus isn't on, hey, 20 years from now, 10 years from now. I just don't see that as much.
Do you think he worries about long term, or whether he's more focused on the trying to change things now? You know, the world structure. I mean, what world structure does he ultimately wind up?
I think his view is, what he would articulate is, a world in which everyone carries their weight, a world in which everyone is aggressively involved in playing a part in security, as an example, is a better world for the United States. I think that's one of his premises, one of his arguments that he makes. Part that I think is gonna be interesting over time in some ways is, can these other nations make those changes? Do they have the political will? Do they have the capability? Do they have the means? If they do, hey, strategy worked great. If they don't, what are the implications for us? Because if it doesn't work the way you think you're gonna do, the way you think it will or the way you hope it will, that argues to me, what does the compensating strategy look like? Or do you sit there and say, well, I'm not gonna do a compensating strategy, it's up to them. I would say, I'm not sure that's in the nation's best interest. So there is no doubt we got a high measure of change and instability ahead of us. And look, in fairness, the NATO alliance in 2014, over a decade ago, made a commitment that every member was going to 2% of gross domestic product as their defense budget. That 2014 agreement has been revalidated 3 times in the last 10 years by the alliance. Of the 32 member alliance, that is NATO, I think as we start 24 nations, so we still have 8 or a little under 25% who still haven't. I mean, no disrespect to our northern border teammates, but Canada's defense budget is 1.38%. I'm like, you're an advanced economy, you're a strong nation, and you're literally telling the rest of the alliance, you guys can't afford or are unwilling to meet the standard that you agreed to. In fact, the Canadians 4 months ago now said, well, we'll meet the 2% standard, but we'll need until 2034. I'm going, 20 years to meet a standard that you agreed to? It's not like this was imposed on you. It was you agreed to this, and you have reaffirmed this multiple times. I will tell you, that's the kind of thing that the president looks at, and it drives him up the wall. You know, come on, you don't care. You don't really want to do it. You're living off our investment.
So, but aren't we running the risk of a permanent schism between Europe and the U.S.? I mean, aren't the downsides of possible downsides of the approach really significant?
Look, it certainly could be. The thing that I'm interested in is, so what comes next after the current administration? Is it a continuation of many of these fundamental changes that this administration has been arguing are appropriate? Do we go back to a more traditional view? Do our alliances and friends look at us right now and go, boy, I don't like what I'm seeing, but the Americans have another election in 4 years. We'll have a different leadership. Hey, let's wait and see. I don't know how this is going to turn out. What I'm hoping is our friends and allies remember that the nature of our relationship with them extends decades. So could we just not focus on one particular small subset? Could we think about how we have sustained these relationships over time and how these relationships have generated value for both parties, us as well as others? Because in the end, what you really want is something where the parties believe that whatever the strategy is, whatever the approach is, it generates mutual benefit for for both sides. That one side is not achieving advantage at the cost of another's.
And someone always sets me up for asking a question about nuclear proliferation.
There you go.
That's how I spent my career. But what is the effect of what's going on now on things like the non-proliferation treaty? I just read this morning where the Polish leadership is saying, well, maybe they ought to start thinking about developing nuclear weapons so that they can help, you know, in their own defense. Other nations are the same way. Russia's been rattling the nukes since the beginning. I mean, is that something that's possible, that the non-proliferation treaty will be undercut by all of this?
Well, first of all, remember, one of the bases of the arms control agreements, like the non-proliferation treaty and others, one of the bases of the agreement was an independent verification mechanism that both parties signed up to. And what the U.S. has found is that particularly the Russians are no longer abiding by the verification mechanisms. And so the U.S. says, so why should I be in an agreement broadly that I can't verify if the other side is adhering to it, if they're actually executing what they agreed to? So that's one issue. Then you have to acknowledge, so for example, if you look at, not that you guys would care, but if you look at Russian nuclear doctrine under Putin, they've made this public. The Russians now have a nuclear doctrine that says you can use nuclear weapons at a tactical level that will not trigger a strategic response for an adversary. You got to go back to the 1960s. I mean, we, the United States, walked away from that in the 1970s. And we said, wait a second. You use a weapon, you've triggered a strategic threshold. The adversary is going to respond. And not just at the same small tactical, the adversary will be concerned that you've crossed the threshold and they will feel they need to respond at a large strategic level. So the Russians are getting real, which is one reason why in the Ukrainian conflict, when Putin would talk about, well, you know, we may be prepared to use nuclear weapons, that got the attention of the United States, because we're looking at this and we're going, well, these guys believe that you could actually use a 5-kiloton, 10-kiloton weapon on the battlefield in Ukraine, and the Americans would not start launching ICBMs into Moscow, that, hey, we can do this without tripping a response threshold. So the U.S. has become very concerned about that. At the same time, China's expanding its nuclear capabilities more than any other large nation in the world, to include the United States, which is interesting because in the past, the Chinese felt that the West and the Russians wasted way too much money on nuclear weapons, that at some point, how many do you need? You need enough to create a credible deterrent, but do you need enough that, five and six times the amount that you would actually potentially ever use? So the Chinese, Mao in particular, argued, hey, let them spend the billions of dollars. We're not going to replicate them. The Chinese seem to have come to a different opinion these days, that in fact a larger nuclear weapons capability for them is now in their best interest. So you look at what they're building, it's the largest, and they're building more than anybody else in the world at the moment.
I think we got time for maybe one or two more questions.
One or two more, baby. Take us home. Here we go.
There we go. What role does the domestic policies and reduction of government, et cetera, what role does that play in the international part of this? Does it make it harder to do it, easier to do it?
Well, first of all, my sense when I travel around the world, from Asia to Europe to the Middle East, is that much of the outside world is very perplexed by what they're seeing, in the sense that, okay, I understand that you want government to be more effective, more efficient. I understand you might believe that there's a level of bloat or excess in government, but the execution seems to be somewhat haphazard and all over the place. I often hear this when I'm traveling around the world. Could you help us understand, Admiral, what's going on? And I say, look, what you're seeing is a very business-like approach to the idea of significantly cutting government. I look what's going on, and I'm going, guys, you've read this before. Look at what Musk did in his acquisition of X. I'm going, he's doing the same thing. He's just doing it in the government now. His experience as a business guy, my sense, never spoken to the individual, so don't know. My sense is his view is, look, there is so much excess and inefficiency in the government that we can whack some level of that, and the government will be able to reconstitute, reshape. And if we get it wrong, we just rehire them. That is very much the commercial model. You see this all the time in the private sector. Many of you have probably experienced this in your own business lives. The challenge as a guy who spent 37 years in government is, okay, government is not a business. It's not run the same way. It doesn't have the same series of, for example, we put checks and balances in government. We're concerned about inefficiency. We're concerned about fraud because we're not using shareholder money that a shareholder said, you know, I believe in this company. I believe in its risk. I'm going to invest in it. No, instead we go, you the taxpayer, and we say, you don't get a choice. Guess what? This is what you're going to pay the government. So you don't get the option. You don't get the buy-in. So the first thing I always try to remind non-government people looking at government is the model is totally different. It's funded by citizens who didn't get to make a choice. It's not like they got to choose an investment. They had to pay what they were directed to pay. And they don't get to choose, other than through their elected representatives, they don't get into how it's spent, how it's prioritized. Secondly, many of the skills within government, it's not unique to government, you see this in the private sector to some extent, but air traffic controllers, people with expertise in nuclear, look, it takes decades to grow this expertise. You just don't create it in a year or two. So making cuts for the sake of making cuts without asking, okay, so what are the implications of this? And then lastly, if you've been cut by the government and you get told, hey, guess what? All is forgiven. You want to come back? I suspect a lot of government employees are going to say, what? The takeaway from this experience so far has been, I picked a career where I had no control and an independent entity suddenly showed up and I'm out of a job. Hey, maybe I need to go to the private sector where perhaps I have a few more protections and I got a little bit more stability. So I'm just going, it's just not exactly the same. But we'll have to, again, we'll have to see how it plays out. I tell people, I have this discussion with my own family, give it 6 months. This summer when people try to go to Acadia and they can't, the lines, hey, look, we had to reduce staffing by a third. We're only allowing X amount of people into the park. Or why is it that my IRS refund took 6 months to get to me instead of the historic 2 or 3 months? When the public starts, if they start seeing impact, I said, look, it'll be very different. But at the moment, broadly, most Americans seem to say, okay, government probably is ineffective. Government probably is bloated. Government probably is too big. Hey, let's see how it's going to play out. And most citizens so far to me are taking it, hey, let's wait and see before we get really agitated about this. Now, if you work in government, you got a different attitude. If you've got family in government, you got a different attitude. But I think the majority of Americans are very much of the, let's see how this plays out. And I'm the first to acknowledge we're not going to know that for 6 months or so, I don't think. Thank you very much,
everybody.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured Admiral Michael Rogers in conversation with George Look, the board president of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. It was recorded live in Rockland on March 10th. If you missed part of the program or want to listen again, you can find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Sam Tracy. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.